Well, let's see how Jesus did treat the Bible. We begin with the Old Testament. And immediately you may wonder how we could ever get any farther than that, because the New Testament wasn't in existence when Jesus was on earth. So how could he possibly say anything about that? Well, we'll see that in a few minutes. But let's begin with the Old Testament. The Old Testament was in existence when Jesus was on earth, and we want to see how he treated it, what his attitude toward it was. Note, first of all, that Jesus never negatively criticizes the Old Testament. He never negatively criticizes the Old Testament. I made this point once, and a professor of religion said, that isn't true at all. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says over and over again, "But I say unto you," instead of what the Old Testament says. And it flashed across my mind at that moment that all religion teachers ought to have boulders put around their necks, and they ought to be thrown into the depths of the sea. Perhaps a slight exaggeration. There's at least one who shouldn't. How could anybody conceivably look at the text of the Sermon on the Mount and conclude that? Jesus says, "It has been said of old time, you shall not commit adultery. But I say unto you, he who looks on a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Now I suppose that means that Jesus is saying, adultery, I don't mind that. That's perfectly okay. It's just the grubby Old Testament that's trying to prohibit adultery. What I'm concerned about is not lusting. We want you not to lust. But adultery, well, there you are. What about the verse in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, "Thou shalt," it has been said of old time, "thou shalt not kill. But I say unto you, if you hate in your heart, you have already killed." Jesus is surely not saying there, down with the Old Testament for its prohibition on killing. My concern is hatred. He's not saying that in the slightest. The "but" in those passages, of course, means not only, but also. Jesus is extending the Old Testament teaching. He's not contradicting it. Indeed, Jesus uses the passages of the Old Testament that we find today to be the most difficult. He uses those passages as bases for his own doctrinal teaching. If I were to do a survey of those passages of the Old Testament that give people the most trouble today, I'll bet that the conclusion would be that they consist of the first chapters of Genesis, the Adam and Eve story, then secondly, Noah and the ark, and thirdly, Jonah and the whale. These are the stories in the Old Testament that people today think are children's stories. Ha, 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 isn't that fun? It's the sort of thing you grow up and away from as you do with Santa Claus and Uncle Sam. Or perhaps not Uncle Sam here in California, but in those more liberal political areas, we feel that way. In any case, look at the way Jesus deals with each of those passages. He uses the Adam and Eve story as the basis of his own teaching on marriage and divorce. The Pharisees come to him and they say, "Moses allowed a bill of divorcement." Jesus says, "From the beginning it was not so." And then he quotes Genesis, "For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall be of one flesh." Now, it's perfectly plain that a factual issue is being dealt with there, the factual issue of whether you can divorce or not. And the Pharisees present that factual issue, and Jesus replies with a factual reference to Genesis, that from the beginning, marriage was made indissoluble. How about Noah and the ark? Well, if you check the places where Jesus quotes or cites or refers to the Noah story, you will discover that in every instance he ties this to his second coming. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be when the Son of Man comes. They were eating and drinking and marrying, giving in marriage, and the flood came and took them. That's also the way in which this is used in Peter. Peter says, people think everything is going to remain exactly the same. Do they forget the flood? The flood was promised, wasn't it? And it came exactly as it was promised, and that's the way it's going to be at the end of time. Then it was by water, next time it's going to be by fire. That derives from Jesus' own use of the flood materials. And Jesus is saying here, quite obviously, just as factually as I'm going to come again, so the flood actually occurred. Surely Jesus would not use a literary parallel for a factual event, if his point is to emphasize the factuality of it. Jonah and the whale. Of course, it isn't whale in the Hebrew, it's Leviathan. Leviathan. That word in Hebrew means a big beast, a monster. All right, could be land monster, sea monster, whatever. And the King James translators, wanting to do a version in English that would be readable by people, thought of the biggest sea monster that they had ever heard of, and it was a whale. So they translated Leviathan by whale. But we don't know what kind of a monster it was. It might have been a monster specially produced for the occasion, a Jonah-eating monster, one whose gastronomical interests were solely limited to people whose name was Jonah. I mean, for all we know, we don't know what kind of a beast it was. But Jesus says, as Jonah was in the belly of this thing, so I will be in the earth and I will rise again. Rudolf Bultmann, the higher critic of the New Testament, one of the most radical higher critics of our time, one of the leading advocates of the form-critical method, has said that obviously Jesus is paralleling his resurrection with Jonah. The Greek word used there is kaphos, even as Jonah was in the beast, so I will be in the earth. And says Bultmann, since we all know that Jonah is a myth, we shouldn't be uncomfortable in the least with the resurrection as a myth. And thus Bultmann argues for a general and total demythologization, a removal of myth from the gospel material, just as so many people easily remove this kind of mythical stuff from the Old Testament. I had a friend who nearly lost his Christian faith as a result of carrying out that kind of parallel. He had studied at Basel under Karl Barth, and Barth, of course, took a very loose attitude toward Old Testament miracles of the sort that Jonah represents. And this fellow, as a result of studying under him, felt that there was no sense in regarding Jonah as a factual kind of affair. And then one day he woke up to the fact that that it was parallel with the resurrection. And at that point he had to make a choice. And thank God he made the choice in favor of the historicity of both of them rather than the non-historicity of both of them. Now, of course, there are people who say Jesus could have used a literary allusion. You know, we will say, as Macbeth did something, so, or as Hamlet did something, so I will do something. But that is really a weak kind of argumentation. Where the issue is factual, you're going to use a factual parallel. If I were concerned to tell you that I really go to France each year and I live over there, do you think I would say something like this? Why, as Icarus flew up to the sun, so I fly Air France to Europe every year. Nonsense! Because the minute that I use that kind of parallel, that would put my flying by Air France into question due to the character of the analogy. And if the argument is that the people of Jesus' day didn't know that Jonah and the whale was mythical, but Jesus knew, then we get into a subject which we're going to be discussing in a little bit, namely the kenotic theory, whether Jesus limited himself to the knowledge of his day. And we'll see that the problems connected with that are far too great to allow that sort of interpretation. Fact of the matter is that in all of these three instances, three of the most difficult instances in the Old Testament, Jesus clearly regarded the material as factual. Notice also that Jesus never makes that distinction that some people make today between the theological stuff in the Bible and the non-theological stuff. Today there are people in our circles, in evangelical circles, who maintain a position called limited inerrancy. That is, the Bible is inerrant where it deals with theology and morals and ethics and that sort of thing, with religion, but it isn't necessarily reliable when it deals with history, geography, science, secular matters, that kind of thing. Jesus never makes that distinction, never once. In fact, Jesus quotes from all over the Old Testament. He puts verses from one book of the Old Testament next to verses from another. He never compares authors. You never hear him saying, now Ezekiel says this, whereas Isaiah, in his cultural situation, says that. The kind of statement that you get in Old Testament histories today, textbooks of Old Testament history, you never find in Jesus. Jesus says simply, it is written. It is written. Written by whom? That happens to be a passive in the Greek, and it requires a personal agent. Who is the personal agent? Personal agent, obviously, is God. Jesus is saying, this has been written by God. And he regards the whole of the Old Testament that way. It's very instructive to see how Jesus deals with the devil in the wilderness in the passage where he encounters him in the wilderness at the beginning of the Synoptic Gospels. That's interesting because according to those passages, there were no contemporaries around. There was no audience for those encounters. It wasn't a situation where Jesus could even conceivably be fitting his teachings in with anything of his own time. And the devil quotes Scripture in those instances. Devil quotes the Old Testament. Now there would have been the perfect opportunity for Jesus to disabuse his followers, eventually, of a notion of fundamentalism. What he could well have said, and it could well have been put into King James English in the 17th century, though I will not attempt to do so, he could very well have said to the devil, come now, let's stop all this fundamentalist proof texting. Stop quoting as if that settled the issue. Let's get to the true theological heart of the problem. But Jesus never says anything roughly like this. Instead, he quotes Scripture right back to the devil. And one of the things he quotes is, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, from Deuteronomy. You see what's going on there? The devil quotes out of context. And Jesus says, the trouble with you is not that you quote the Bible, but you don't take all of it. If you took all of it, if you took all the Old Testament, you'd get this in context. And if you got it in context, then you wouldn't be perverting it. All right, the upshot of this is that Jesus held to the entire reliability of the Old Testament. Even a number of liberal Old Testament scholars and New Testament scholars agree to this. They say, sure, Jesus did. After all, every Orthodox Jew of his time took that view. Nobody was being critical of the Old Testament. Everybody thought that it was the very Word of God. Do you know that there were rabbis of that time who, if you struck a needle through a scroll of the Old Testament, could name every word through which the needle passed? The view of the Bible was the strictest kind of view. When Jesus talked about the jot and the tittle, he was talking about even the shading of the letters. There was a very, very strong, powerful view of the authority of the Bible maintained by the Jews of his day. All right. Jesus' view of the Old Testament is definitely a view that the Old Testament is a reliable book and not to be criticized. He quotes it as absolute authority, and he doesn't distinguish secular stuff from religious stuff in any sense of the word. However, it is argued in opposition to this that just because Jesus said that this was the case doesn't necessarily mean it is, even if he's God. And how is that argued? It's argued in terms of the kenotic theory. Kenotic theory, K-E-N-O-T-I-C. The noun is kenosis. Kenosis is not a summer conference ground for evangelicals, though you may have thought it was. No, kenosis is a Greek word which means limitation. It's a Greek word meaning limitation. And it's used in Philippians, where it says that Jesus emptied himself and became a man. The verb translated emptied himself is the verb from this root. Here's how the argument goes. It has two forms. Form number one. In order to become a man, Jesus had to be limited to the knowledge of his own day. In other words, if he came zooming down into this world with divine knowledge, he wouldn't have been a true man. The only way for him to be a true man is for him to have the kind of human knowledge that people had in his own time. So, since they believed in the inerrant authority of the Old Testament, he believed in the inerrant authority of the Old Testament, but that doesn't mean that that's necessarily the case. We today know better because we have advanced knowledge that he didn't have about the problems in the Bible. Second form of the argument. Jesus didn't have to be limited in his knowledge, but he chose to be limited in his knowledge in certain respects. In other words, while he was here on earth, he consciously chose not to disturb the ideas of his own time where that would cause an unnecessary disturbance. He tried to conform his ideas to the ideas of his time so as not to create a disjunction in communication. In order to communicate with people in his own time, he made certain that his statements were in conformity with the statements of his culture. One or the other of these kenotic theories is very, very widely held today. You'll find these theories held by many, many people at the present time. And if you look at them fairly closely, you will note that they are quite clever, because on the basis of these theories, you can have your cake and eat it too. That is to say, you can hold to the deity of Christ and yet at the same time agree to all kinds of biblical criticism that makes the Old Testament look like a very unreliable book. And there's no doubt about the fact that that's been one of the strong motivations in kenotic theory. But what about the validity or non-validity of these views? Well, kenotic theory is way off base, way, way off base, and we want to see exactly how. Let's first of all begin with the idea that Jesus had to be limited to the knowledge of his own day in order to be a true man. The assumption behind this idea is that if you have advanced knowledge, you're not truly human. That's the underlying assumption. If you have advanced knowledge, you're not truly human. But think about that for a moment. Is that the proper way to define humanity or humanness? If it is, then Einstein was subhuman, because the knowledge that Einstein had, the perception, the intelligence, the ability to determine cosmological questions and the like, with Einstein apparently went tremendously beyond the knowledge of his own time. I think we would tend to look at it just the opposite, wouldn't we? We would say that he was a particularly fine representative of humanity, The knowledge that he had was certainly beyond that of his contemporaries, but that is something to be said for his humanity, not against it. The amount of knowledge a person possesses has nothing whatever to do with his degree of humanity. But it's thinking like that that has brought us to all kinds of bizarre conclusions. Let me just mention one of them. In the Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision on abortion, the conclusion of the court is that during the first trimester of pregnancy, the fetus deserves no legal protection. What that says, in essence, is that when someone doesn't yet have his brain formed, he isn't a human. In other words, you've got to have a certain knowledge level, you've got to arrive at a certain level of mature development before you can be considered human. As critics of the Roe versus Wade decision have emphasized, once you start that kind of thing, there's absolutely no stopping it. Then it's possible to go to the end of life, and if you find somebody who isn't thinking very clearly, you can suggest eliminating him, thereby creating a more healthy human race. And you begin to ask questions about the mentally deformed and those who lack mental capacity as compared with other people. And suddenly you are defining out of the human race all kinds of people on the basis of their intelligence level or their mental powers. This kind of thing is a complete misconception of what it means to be human. To be human, what you need is a human genetic pattern. And you get a human genetic pattern at the moment of conception. You get your total human genetic pattern at that point, and at that point you start being, and you don't cease being until that human genetic pattern ceases to operate by physical death. All right. In other words, Jesus didn't have to be limited in knowledge in order to be human. Moreover, suppose he did have to be limited in knowledge in order to be human. What would that say about everything he taught? It would say, wouldn't it, that anything that he taught was conditioned by his own time. It wouldn't be limited to his views of the Bible. But under those circumstances, what could you rely on? How would you be able to distinguish the things he said that were of eternal importance from the things that weren't? Everything he said would be colored in some fashion by the temporal situation, but you would have no standard for judging what things were permanent and what things weren't. Two German scholars, Strack and Billerbeck, did a work a number of years ago. This is a work in German. It's never been translated into English, but it's a basic reference work for New Testament studies, and it's called A Commentary on the New Testament from the Midrashim, from the Talmud. The Midrashim were writings done by Jews between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And these two scholars take the writings of Jesus, the New Testament writings, and they compare what Jesus says with things that were said by rabbis before Jesus' time. And they, this is arranged from Matthew, Matthew 1:1 on to the end of the material, and you look under a verse, and there you see the similar statements made by Jewish religious leaders before the time of Jesus. And it is perfectly remarkable to note how much of what Jesus said had already been said by other people. Not in the same context, but nevertheless, the same sort of things said by other people. If you began to think that Jesus had to be limited to the ideas of his time, once you have noticed these parallels, your conclusion would be that there was hardly a thing Jesus said that couldn't very well have simply been picked up from the ideas circulating in his time. And you would end up not being informed by anything Jesus said in any eternal sense. Let me give you an analogy on this. You remember that I said that I could arrive in the city here with a long white beard and a white robe. And on arriving, I announced that one thing hadn't been put into the publicity for these lectures, namely that I am God. Now, as I'm getting off the plane saying this, there is a little dog running up, and I give him a good swift kick. And you say, now just a moment, you claim to be God and you treat that little dog that way? And I say, just a moment, you don't understand that incarnation involves kenosis. And of course I am limited to the moral ideas of my own time. And therefore, I have no objection to kicking dogs because other people in my own time right now kick dogs. You think about this for a few minutes and it bothers you, but you let it go. And then comes my public lecture. And I give a public lecture, and this contains factual errors and misuse of logic. It is a catastrophe as a lecture. And afterwards, you say to me, how can you possibly claim to be God and say that sort of thing? And I say, you don't remember what I told you at the plane. When God becomes man, in order for him to become truly man, he of course is limited to the knowledge of his own time. And I'm in that position. Certainly there were errors and contradictions in what I said. Certainly my judgments are not necessarily absolute judgments. But that's just because I'm a human being. I'm here on earth as a human being, and so you've got to expect that sort of thing. Your reaction to this, your proper reaction would be, that kind of a God I can do without. Why? Because that kind of a God gives you nothing that you didn't have already. Because you can get human opinion anywhere. What good would an incarnation be that gave you a God who ended up saying nothing other than what human beings say? Obviously, the word God gets totally evacuated of meaning in a situation like this. All you're left with is an ideogram, G-O-D, applied to somebody. You're not left with any actual content at all. Another way to put it is this. What could such a God reveal? What kind of revelation could he supply? Answer, Zerosville, man. He couldn't give you anything. Well, what about the second style of kenosis? The second style is that Jesus didn't have to get into this position, but he chose to. He chose to limit his ideas to his own time so as not to create problems. If you read the New Testament, you can hardly take this seriously. For one thing, he got crucified. Now, if you conform your ideas to your own time and you do anything like an effective job of it, you're not going to get crucified. As you read through the accounts of Jesus' ministry, you find that again and again and again, he criticizes his own time. He criticizes the religious ideas of his own time. He goes after the Pharisees and the Sadducees, hammer and tongs. Once I had a little flirtation with pacifism, and then I read in the Greek of the New Testament that Jesus threw the money changers out of the temple, and the word throw out there is ekbalein, the root of our word ballistics. Huh? The real exegetical question there is the trajectory of each Pharisee as he left the temple area. The fact is that that Jesus took a most severe view of the religious misconceptions of his own time. Now, is it conceivable that when he dealt with the very foundation of Jewish religious ideas, namely the Old Testament, that he would have limited himself to their erroneous ideas? Surely, at that point, he would have corrected them just as much as he corrected them in other respects. Jesus is the world's worst conformist, and you can't suddenly put him into the category of conformist when it comes to these biblical statements that he made. And that shows again that there's something else working here when people present kenotic theory. How come they're willing to accept what Jesus says in other respects, but they don't accept what he says relative to the Bible? Answer, because they think that they're such smarties that they know better when it comes to the Bible. They think that they've got information that is superior to Jesus' information. But if Jesus is God Almighty come to earth, then isn't that a presumptive sort of thing? The kenotic theory is bad news, and it doesn't adequately take into account the data. However, kenotic theorists sometimes cite Jesus' statement about not knowing the hour of his coming, as if that supported kenosis. You know the passage where Jesus says, no man knows the hour of my coming, not the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. What about that? Well, actually, that passage does just the opposite. That passage indicates that Jesus is aware of what he knew and what he didn't. In other words, that Jesus was in control of his own knowledge. If Jesus says, I don't know the hour of my coming, in this one respect I'm limited, then quite obviously he knew that in other respects he wasn't. You couldn't very well expect to have Jesus say, now as to the hour of my coming, I don't know what that is. And then to go on and make statements about other things that he didn't know without bothering to tell you that. The very fact that he states that he doesn't know the hour of his coming indicates that he's concerned that you are aware of what he knows and what he doesn't know. He tells you specifically that on the one point of his coming that he cannot give you information. It follows from that, therefore, that if he goes ahead and gives you other information, then there isn't any limitation connected with it. You see the logic of that? C.S. Lewis, incidentally, followed along this line a bit, but he said that when Jesus then goes ahead and says, there are some people standing here who shall not see death until I come, and this generation shall not pass away until all be fulfilled, that those statements are not accurate because Jesus himself admits that he doesn't know the hour of his coming. That's one of the few instances where Lewis really went off into the mist. You could hardly imagine a person, first of all, saying, quite frankly, I don't know the hour of my coming, and then turn right around and give statements about the hour of his coming. It's hardly that sort of thing. Those verses about Jesus coming are genuine statements, but they are not erroneous. Why? Because when he talks about there are some standing here that shall not see death until the kingdom comes, he's talking about the coming of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. And when he says, this generation shall not pass away till all be fulfilled, the Greek word genea there should be translated race. It means the Jewish race. The Jewish race will still be here when all is fulfilled. The word genea means either race or generation, and it's been consistently badly translated in those verses. So Jesus is not suddenly forgetting that he just told you that he doesn't know the hour of his coming and then tells you some incorrect statement on that subject. Hardly. Jesus was in control of his knowledge. We see this. Jesus stood above his knowledge in the sense of knowing what he knew and what he didn't know. And the only thing he didn't know while he was on earth, according to what he tells us, is that he didn't know the hour of his coming. You can't limit Jesus to the knowledge of his time. Indeed, people said he spake as no other man ever spake, you know? Question raised, isn't it also unfortunate that these people base so much on one verse when there's so much on the other side? Yes, I think that's the case, but maybe we ought to put it a little bit differently. we don't want to use a mass of material in one direction, do we, to crush something that appears to be exceptional in another respect, because that would be going against the kind of principle that we were talking about the other night. The real problem with this is that the people who begin a very careful treatment of this one verse don't themselves believe in the full authority of the text. And that's the thing that makes it so absurd. These are the people that will throw other verses out right and left, but when they finally find one verse that seems to do something for them, then they get all excited about it. That's one of the common characteristics of modern liberal biblical scholarship, that suddenly the liberal becomes a fundamentalist at the point of the verse that he's interested in. Notice that again and again. Bultmann, in his commentary on John, is fascinating in this regard. Bultmann does the most careful exegesis of certain verses in John, those that have to do with what C.H. Dodd called realized eschatology. He really goes to town on those, and then on other verses, whoosh, out they go.